Thanks, Mike, for the introduction. And yeah, I think it's this is the first time I really talk to a physics audience. I was trained as a mathematician, and so but I do like physics, and I read many journals like physics reviews, and certainly read many of Mike's papers. Bob Ross's papers and all this network-related stuff. So, and for statisticians, we always say the smartest people are the physicists, and they have very great ideas, and sometimes we have different opinions whether the probability they explain are just similar as what we try to explain in statistics or something. So, and we try to see some physicists get some very good ideas, and then we try to formalize them, and we try to understand why it works and why it doesn't work and so on. Anyway, so I really admire the physicists, and I try to learn from them. That's why I'm here. So I try to give you a brief introduction about what we have been doing, because this is mainly a week for protein interactions, and we have been working on protein interactions for 4 or 5 years, and I'd like to report what we have obtained here. So one thing that I would like to emphasize here, it's probably the talk is a little different from what you have been used to, and so we tried, it's more statistical than the physics point of view. So if you have any questions, feel free to stop me, and let's just explain them. So the philosophy in my research group is we try to do data integration. So we know that there are a lot of data available, including protein interactions and sequences and SNPs and the protein structures and the gene expression, etc. So our philosophy is that each data source can give us some information about the biological process of interest, but not all. So our objective is to try to integrate all these different data sources and see which data source can answer some of the problems that we are interested in. So that's what we try to do. And so first we start from physical interactions, and then we add some information into our analysis. So here is the outline of my talk, and I would like to, the brief introduction of high throughput genome technology. I believe through all this semester you already know most of them. And then I will talk a little bit about what the genome databases that we have been using, and I suppose some of you mostly are familiar, and then we talk about the general problems, and in particular, I will talk about how do we use the protein interaction network and other data sources to infer protein functions and the protein domain interactions. So this part, I hope, is quite brief, and so this is the yeast 2 hybrid system. I believe you have talked about this before, right? So anyway, so what you get through this yeast 2 hybrid system is that you get a lot of protein interactions, and some of them are true positive, some of them are false positive. How do you evaluate what fraction of those observed protein interactions are true interactions, etc. So the other data source that we use is called genetic interactions. Essentially, what you do is if you knock one gene out, and if the cell survives, and that's viable genes, and if the cell does not survive, that's called the essential genes. So then if you knock two viable genes out, and then the cell does not survive, then this form genetic interactions. So this is typically you see in network papers, and then you get the network, and this node are the proteins, and these edges indicate the interactions. So in this particular figure, the edges indicate genetic interactions. These different colors indicate the functions of these proteins, such as this one. This blue color indicates cell polarity, and so on, you can get all this information. So from here, this figure, we can see what are the network features of this network. And one particular question that we try to see from this different node, and you can see this this yellow one, the yellow one most likely they interact with the yellow one, but there are some possibilities that they interact with another one, this mitosis, and some of them you don't know. So one thing that we try to do around 2002, we try to see whether based on this type of network information, and what can we say about this proteins that you don't know the function, like this type of function. So that's what we proposed at that time. So another data source, they are essentially what's in genetic interaction, the physical interactions from the yeast to hybrid system is a pairwise relationship. Another type of relationship is called protein complexes. And there, essentially, you don't see whether this pair are interacting with each other or not, and then whether they form a complex or not. So that's the group-wise relationship. And this is the technique. And this one, I believe most of you are quite familiar with this one, that's the gene expression. So over the years, for the protein interaction database, most of our study use the MIPS, the physical interaction database, that because the most of them are from the small scale experiment. And another database that we find that especially it's a core protein interaction database in the database of interacting proteins. And this one we think is from our previous experience, we think these two are probably the BIP core database have similar reliability as this MIPS. And these two, we didn't really use these two, but these are the two databases that we used most widely. So another thing, when we talk about the functions of these unknown proteins, then naturally we see the gene entomology database. And I believe most of you have used this database before. Okay, so that's the brief introduction about the data structure. And so what we have studied over the years, that's the first thing that we try to study is from the yeast to hybrid system, you get many, many protein interaction data. And the one thing that you try to study is that what fraction of this observed protein interactions are true interactions. Otherwise, most of them are garbage, and then whatever you use are just garbage in, garbage out. So the first thing that you try to see, how do you estimate what fraction of these protein interactions are really interact with each other or not. So what we did there is the basic observation is that if this we use some gold standard like what is in the MIPS physical interaction database, and we look at there, we correlate that with the gene expression data, then essentially you have the cell cycle data or knockout data and so on, and then you just look at their correlation. And then you look at the correlation, the Pearson correlation between the really interacting proteins, and then you look at the random pairs of what are the correlations. And the one thing that you can see is for the really interacting protein pairs, and their correlation tend to be higher than those the random pairs. So using that things, and then you can try to model that observed protein interactions as a mixture of true interactions and random pairs. And then the problem becomes, how do you estimate this this fraction? How do you estimate this fraction? So although the idea is very, very simple, and I'm happy to say that by the end of 2006, Tree Dex group, that's another group from UCSD, doing a lot of experimental and computational protein interactions. And they say that although over 4 years and many methods have been applied, that including the D distinguishing trees and forests and so on. There are a lot of machine learning tools. And this technique, that's the simplest technique, seems to outperform all those later methods in four criteria out of four criteria that they use to compare all these different approaches. And that was published by the end of 2006 in BMC Bioinformatics. For those of you who would like to get some information, you can check that paper. So, another thing that attention is now you have many protein interaction data, and the proteins contain many, many different domains, and you have multiple domain proteins. Domains are those that perform the key functions, and then you now you try what you observe, like from the yeast to hybrid system, it's the protein-protein interactions. You only know which protein interact with which protein, but you biologists really care about which domain are really interact, which part of the protein really interact with each other, so that you try to perturb that domain and so on. And our question is, can you predict which pair of domains interact based on protein-protein interactions? And that's, many techniques had, we first proposed some method that published in 2002, and there are many other methods that is coming out over the years, and I will, if I have time, I will briefly talk about this part. And this part is, some overlap with Michael's group is on the network motif related things. So now you have the network, and then you have now there are some several groups say that in the network there are some network motifs like the feedback loop, and then how do you model that, and how do you see if this feedback loop are really significant or not. So I will not talk about that, and I think it's Mike and the postdoc is doing a lot of much fancy work than what we are doing. So, and the other things is what we are doing is we try to integrate the gene expression data and the protein interaction data, try to see if you can use protein interaction data to more efficiently prioritize genes. So what we are doing there is, suppose you have a phenotype like hypertension or diabetes or something, and then you try to see, most people do is just using the gene expression, and you look at the gene expression for those diabetes patient cases and for those controls, and you look at whether the genes are differentially expressed or not, such as T statistics or not, and then based on that T statistics, you rank them. And now, what we try to do is, can you incorporate protein interaction data to modify your ranking so that your ranking make more sense? That's the basic idea there. If they interact with each other, then they probably either all of them are involved in the disease or they not involved in the disease. So another thing that we did was presented last year is in the ISMB conference, is we try to see, can we use protein interaction data plus the other information like transcription factor information to infer the pathway. Suppose you're doing some perturbation and you have given a drug and you see that some genes are perturbed, and some of these genes perturbed, but does not mean that it's directly this drug or some perturbation just directly perturb that gene, and there are some intermediate genes that is going through this process. That's the pathways that how the perturbations perturb that the differentially expressed genes. That what is the intermediate pathways that perturb these genes. So that's then I will talk. So that's essentially over the years, and how do we use this protein interaction data to answer some of the biological problems. So I will give you two topics more carefully. One is how do you predict the protein functions by integrating protein interactions and the other information. And in particular, I would say this, they predicted the protein interactions based on protein interaction network. Actually, it turned out to be what we used, what we call it microrandom field model, but actually you can think it as Gibbs distribution. That's certainly closely related to physics. So before I really say something about how do we what do we mean by function? I mean, one is you can define any function that you want, and my particular like gene ontology, you have this directed DAC structure. So essentially, you have this first level of functions, and you have this you have the second layer and the third layer, and so on. So now, any of this you can call it a function. And in particular, if a protein is essential or not, that's also it's a function. So it's I would say it's the function is probably it's quite more general than what we say is function. You can define any function, or you can define any node in those gene ontology. Try to see if that's a function you are interested in. So that's essentially it's the essential genes are those that when you mutate it or knock out, and then it will the cell will not survive, and that's what we are doing here at the yeast. Okay, and so and we try to understand what is the relationship between protein essentiality and the genomic information, that's including the network information. So one thing that I mean this is actually it's getting quite famous. It's from Barabasi's group, that essentially we can see it that as we use the protein physical interaction in the MIPS database. And so what you can see here is as the degree increases in this protein interaction network and the protein essentiality, the fraction of those proteins that are essential just increases. That's it's obvious. And so then you also can see that if you use the neighbors for these essential genes, and if you look at their neighbors and what fraction of their neighbors are essential. And so you can see that for essential genes and the fraction of their neighbors are essential are just this the histogram, you can see it's significantly higher than this. These are the no essential and what the fraction of essential. So you can clearly see that part. So, so certainly there are some debate on that part, but I think it's I look at the, some of this debate about whether the degree and the essentiality really the really see difference or not, and some people say it's not. And but when I look at their study, they use just two hybrid system or Wu's system. From that, and you really don't see the difference. I mean, you don't see it's increasing. And I would contribute that to the most of the data in the Wu's data. It's not reliable, actually. It's and we estimate, I mean, that's related to the first project. If you use Wu's protein interaction data, and then what we estimate is 10% of the Wu's data are really interacting, and 90% of them are not really interacting. So if you use that data, certainly you don't get anything. That's another thing that we just look at for the gene ontology categories, and what categories are really affect the essentiality of the gene. And you can see that this is, I mean, I will tell you what is number 4 and what is number 26 and 27 means. And so, okay, so now you can see here is for this, it's the RNA processing, and 26 is the messenger RNA processing, and 27 is the RNA splicing. So you can see all those that on the top ones are really related to RNA processing, and what we used here is what we so-called informative node. And if you run through all these processes, and you see that you don't see the RNA processing anymore in the all these 34 nodes, these 28 nodes. It makes sense that these essential genes are really related to RNA processing. That's the simple way to do that. And so that's also the conservation, and we say it's conserved genes are more likely to be essential, and that's in biology, that's true. Okay, so what we try to do is, the next thing is, given a function of interest, we try to see, can you predict the function of those unknown proteins? For yeast, probably that's not that important, because most of those, if you knock one gene out, and most of them you already know, so you really don't need to predict the protein essentiality. But on the other hand, you can use that as a benchmark to see if your stuff is king. No, it's just the yeast. Just the yeast, yeah. Okay, so now let me tell you how they are, in my thinking, there are two key methods that are currently available. Given the network information, how do you predict the functions of unknown proteins? And one is, we say, it's the Markov random field framework, and that's, I mean, we first developed that, and there are some physicists actually from my, from Barabasi's group, as well as from Simon Kassaf's group in BU, Boston University, and they that's this group. And then there is another computer science way of doing that, that's called supporting vector machines. And there, essentially, it's what you do is, now given the network, and you define some way of similarity between the protein pairs, and now you essentially get a kernel, some called kernel, and then you try to classify the genes into having this function and not having this function. So let me briefly introduce what is, I think it's, I tried, actually the Markov random field stuff that we published first, clearly that it's not as powerful as prediction purposes, as not powerful as the supporting vector machine. But we tried to improve the Markov random field framework, and then we try to see that as for prediction accuracy, we try to see whether we can get to that level, and now we report that result. So one is, this is what do we mean by diffusion kernel. So now now suppose you are given a network, like a protein interaction network. This is essentially given there. And so one question there is, how do you define how do you define the distance or similarity between any two proteins? And that's the basic question. And you can define a variety of different ways. And one simple way you see is, if they interact with each other, you give it similar, it's similar equal to one. And if it's otherwise, you give it zero. So that's one way of defining the distance. Another way you try to think is another fancy way is, I just, on this network, I define the shortest distance between any two pairs, and they see what is the distance between them, and then that's another way of defining similarity. Another way, and through the years, we find that it's most useful to us, at least for the problem that we studied so far, is called the diffusion kernel. What is the diffusion kernel? Essentially, you can think it's in the probability sense that you do a random walk on those network. So essentially, you start from one node, and then you randomly walk according to the degree. Now you have the degree. And so you random walk on this network, like 1 over p, now the degree is k, 1 over k probability you take a random pass, and then you go to another node, and then you start from there, and you go to a random node, you go to another one. So essentially the question is, what is the average expected distance from this node to the other node, and then you use that as a singularity. And so this way, it's you naturally take into account the degree information in this network, and that's we find that for many of the problems we studied, then this seems to be the perfect similarity measure in the network. So that's actually it's used in a lot of the supporting vector machine tools. So mathematically, it will be just like this is the definition of the diffusion kernel. H is defined this way, and if the interactor, you give it one, and if for ij, and for the degree itself, and you just minus di, and so on. And so now this is just to get the similarity, that's the diffusion kernel. So, and now let's the diffusion kernel has nothing to do with the function of those coroutines. It's just based on the network. Now let's put the functions onto these proteins. Now fixed main function. And if this protein has this function, and you put it at you give it a variable one, and if it does not have this function, you give it a number zero. And now essentially this, for all this, like in the yeast, you have 6,000 proteins, and then you just have 0, 1 to the power of 6,000. That's essentially it's you can think it as a particle system or latest model or whatever. So essentially it's getting to x1, x2, xn, the x 6,000, and then that's your variable. That's your variable. And now the one question is what probability that you assign to this random vector or lattice. So that's the question. So suppose you forget about the network, and what do you see? I mean, essentially, if you assume that each protein has the function with probability pi, that essentially get to the pi to the n1 and y minus pi to the n0. That's essentially the binomial distribution. And the n0 is the number of proteins having that, does not have that function, and n1 is the proteins having that function. Now let's get into the network. Now for those proteins that they are connected, let's only look at those connected ones. And if they connected, it's, we put some weight like beta 1, 0. If it's one node is one and the other node is zero, and this is beta 1, 0. And if both nodes have this function, you give it weight of beta 1, 1. And if both have does not have this function, it gives you a beta of beta 0, 0. So now essentially you get this one. So here the difference, the key here is that I use the diffusion kernel to measure the any two pairs. I don't just use 0, 1. In the original Markov Randall field model, we use Kij just equal to 0 if it's not interacting, and equal to 1 if it's interacting. And later we just see that let's just use diffusion kernel, And so now essentially that's what we used, and now you can get this, you can think this as the latest model in the physics field, or what we call it, the microrandom field model, but it's frankly speaking, these two are not different. I mean, it's depending on whether you know the parameter or so on, and it's just different names. So now you can see this is getting to some of the talks. You see this quite often. I mean, even in Dr. Wang's talk, you can get this potential, and this is just the normalization constant, and this is what we call the potential in this network. So from this one, you can get this conditional. The conditional on all the other things, conditional on all the other notations, if you know the function for all the other proteins, and what is the probability that this ice protein have this function, and this is just a quite a standard Markov random field theory, or you can think in the latest model things. That's just logistic regression. Okay, so now I already said about what's the difference between the Markov random field model and the diffusion kernel based Markov random field model. And the diffusion kernel, it is, if you let this one, just then the diffusion kernel just become Markov random field model. So now you really don't know what is alpha, and you don't know what is beta, and so on. And then you, what is your final objective is to try to estimate. So now what will be the input of this problem is, one is the network, the protein-physical interaction network. The other one is you try to, it's the functions of these known proteins. You already know what the function of these proteins. And so the objective is you try to conditional on the functions of these annotated proteins and the network. And you try to estimate what is the posterior probability of the protein that have this function. That's become a computational problem. So that's, that's even in physics or in statistics, and we just use this Markov chain and the color stuff to get this update, and then you get the estimate of these posterior probabilities. So that's the basic idea of the predicting the protein functions using the protein interaction data, and these are some how do you evaluate the approach, whether this your method will work or not. And so we do here is using cross validation. So and here I think I will, because of the time issues, what I just see is this our publication indicates that this one, if you change the Markov original Markov random field model to the diffusion kernel based Markov random field model, then the performance is similar to the supporting vector machine, and the supporting vector machine uses the diffusion kernel actually. So now essentially what we can see here is this one, the in terms of predicting efficiency, and it's the new model, it's essentially give you similar performance as supporting vector machines. But it's, I would like to see a little bit about how now it's the basic protein interaction network, and then certainly you try to consider the other information like protein domain information and other sequence features. And now suppose you have different genetic, different network like physical interactions and genetic interactions, and you also have the correlated genes and the gene profiles and how the correlation, and then you also have the protein complex information and so on. And then you try to see how do you integrate all this different information, and then you build a unified model. Then that's actually it's quite important then, because we try to integrate all this different information. And for the Markov random field model, actually it's quite easy to incorporate all these different models. And I will not give you the basic things. And so this is just the feature selection in this process. So here is just to give you some of this. We use 34 function categories, and then we compare the original Markov random field model. And also this second one is what is the new method, and third one is the supporting vector machine. And you can see sometimes the supporting vector machine perform well, and sometimes the new method perform well, but it generally it's roughly similar. And this is what's our conclusion there. And we, but then you may ask, why do we publish the result if you don't see that this give you better result? And our argument is that using this logistic regression model, you can really do you can really easily do feature selection, and you can say what is the contribution of these different data sources, and that is not easily down in the supporting vacuum machine field. So that's what we see. And actually, it's this is just the contribution of different data sources and so on for these 34 functions. I will not. So actually, this is one thing that domain information that plays the most important role. And then there is the genetic interaction data, and the physical interaction is the physical interaction data also getting some importance and so on. So that's what we did. And actually, it's although this is some our own study, and then recently, actually, this is the most recent. We are still, not me, but I mean, this is a large collaborative blind study on mass function. So what we did, there is all our study are related to the East because the East has the most data. And so, certainly there are other groups that are doing these similar things. And then what we, from Fred Haas, Fred Rice, and also Tim Hughes, and then they are doing, Tim Hughes in Canada, in University of Toronto, is an expert on mouse genetics, and they are doing mouse. So their question is the following. So you guys are doing the model systems, and can we do anything related to mouse? That's the best question. So in order to do that, and the Tim Hughes and the Fritz Rice group, they collect many different data sources. And that's including the protein interaction data in mouse. That's through homology search and or other method you get the protein interactions. And you also have the domain information and the gene expression files. Then they give us three gene expression files. And also the phylogenetic profiles that they compare. I believe it's 150 species. And they try to see if this protein occurred in one of these 150 species. I think most of you know what is the phylogenetic profile is. And then they also see because they work on mouse, and then they try to see if this protein is homologous to a gene in the human that is related to disease or not, and that disease relationship. And in the mouse also there are many phenotypes available, and so what phenotypes, whether it's related to phenotypes or not. So now essentially they give us, so what they did is they collect this all these different data sources. I really admire them that they really get this data source. I think the collaborative effort actually is this is probably the most important part of this things. They collect all these different data sources, and they have 21,000 mouse proteins. And then they give us the part of the proteins that's already known. So now they hide 10% of the known proteins in the mouse. They hide, and they didn't do anything. So essentially they hide, and what they give us are all this information, as well as the 90% of the known proteins. That's what they give the community, the people who are working on this field. And the nine group, I believe it's 9 or 10 group responded to say, if you are interested in this game or not. And because we really don't know whether any of this method will work. And we just try to see if you can do anything with this data. And then they get back, you are asked to predict the function of these proteins, and then you whatever you do, if you learn too much, and then then it's not good. But if you learn not enough, then that's not good either. So whatever, say they hide 10%, and we are not supposed to decode that and whatever. And so you are responsible to give the functions of all those protein predictions to them, and that's one part is the test set, and another part is they try to, because they freeze the data in February Q006, and then they try to see, can you predict those ones that biologically that they started from 2006, from February 2006 to the end of last year. And then you try, these are the novel predictions, and so you try to see if you can predict anything. So this is their things and what our result looks like. And so you know that there are three different processes here, biological functions, and then these are the number of proteins that having the particular function. And if you have on the upper level, it contains many proteins, and if on the lower level, contains less proteins. So now it's 31 to 100 and contain 100 proteins or more. And so you can see for this stuff and what we use cross-validation to validate, to select the parameters or select the data sources that we try to use. And so what we can see here is this is our own cross-validation result, and this is their test result. And so essentially they did the same analysis and they tested. That's the test result. For the novel things, and then this is what what they get. And for this two result test and no novel things, and that's what they get from the result. So essentially, what you can see here is for these things and our cross validation and their test result essentially give you quite a similar performance. So that's we are not overtraining, we are not undertraining. And for the novel things, and this is true for all the nine groups that submitted their result. And for novel things, it's not as useful as for test, but it's certainly reasonable for molecular function. And this actually is quite decent, although it's not perfect. So what we can see from here is the prediction result accuracy. If you look at this one as the mouse, as the yeast, and it's quite similar. And even in the yeast, we just get to this type of accuracy. So we are very, very surprised and we are satisfied with this result, because that indicates the method that you use, it can be used to the high-level organisms. And it can be quite useful. And soon, as for the ranking of our method, I would claim that for different functions, certainly it's different. The rank order can be different, but it's for most of this, our ranking is on the top three out of these nine groups that submitted their result. And for this particular one, actually, it's better than the supporting vector machine. It's, for reasons I'm not exactly clear, but it's certainly I think we did the variable selection. That's probably play some important role, because if you dump all the data into your method, and usually it will not work well, because if the data really does not help you in that direction, and then essentially that will just mess up your result, because it's just add noise. And so model selection is a very important issue. Let me 5 minutes and let me get the idea of this domain interaction stuff. So for domain interactions, essentially here is the basic idea is that this is one protein and this is a single protein. This is the single domain protein. And for this protein, there are two domains. And for these proteins, there are two domains and so on. So based on this type of interaction, these are complex. But you try to understand which pair are really interacting, such as this one interact with this one. Is this because of this interaction, or is this because of this interaction? That's the basic scientific question that you try to ask. So this is the basic protein interactions, and these are the two different things. then how do you study that? So what we think is a missing value problem. Essentially, what you observe is that the proteins are really the input of this one is the following. You have the protein interaction data. That's the input, and then protein domain relationship. It's which protein contain which domains. That's the input of the data. So you know which protein are interacting with which protein, and then but you really don't know is which domain are really interacting with which domain. So now that's essentially what we treat that as a missing value problem. But what is missing is the which domain pair which domain pair is really interact. So what we call it a missing value problem, because what is missing is the domains are really domain pairs are missing. But but you know the final outcome. So essentially what you try to get it from all these observations, you try to see whether you partition that domain your protein interaction into different domain component, and then it become a so-called expectation maximization problem, and then that's what we used. So now essentially we certainly made some very simplified assumptions, unrealistic assumptions, and we assume that the domain pairs are interacting independently. And if this interact, it's the other pair interact, it's independent, that's certainly it's not realistic. And then, but based on that things, and then we can get these probabilities, and then we can get the EM things, that you have all these different probabilities and so on. Then I think I will not really give you any results there. So what I would say is these are something that these are from the other groups, that from Hong Yu Zhao's group from Yale. Essentially, they compared the different method for predicting the domain interactions based on protein interactions. The one is the so-called the sequence information, that's the so-called association method. And this one is the attraction repulsion method. And this is attraction only. So this is our method. So you can see here it's for these two essentially roughly give you similar result. And then what they did is try to extend, because this one is you can get to multiple, you already have a likelihood function. You can extend it to multiple organisms. So what they did is they extend this method to four different model organisms, and then they do the integrative approach to see whether this give you more accurate or more broad domain interaction database. So another one that is I would say it, I like it very much actually, is from David Eisenberg's group. And what they did is again they compared they proposed another method. What is it called, another method? Actually what they did is just a very very small modification of our approach. Now what we did is we rank the things according to the lambda, essentially the probability that the domain pair interact. And what their observation is that if you have small number of protein interacting pairs and consistent with this one, and this estimation probably is not reliable. And what they modify our approach is by likelihood ratio. They compare the likelihood of the data on all without any restriction or with the restriction that this protein pair not interact. That's just likelihood ratio things. And then this is a very, actually this improve a lot, and this is some other people's method, and this is our criteria, and this is the modified criteria. It is essentially just the algorithm, essentially it's our algorithm, but it's just the scoring system is different scoring system, and you can see their performance is quite good. And so certainly I like them, and we recently did some work that to try to use all these things. So anyway, so I think the method is getting polished, and how do we integrate all these different data sources to predict domain interactions is another topic that we have been working on for some time. Thanks. I should get some the very end to the acknowledgement part. Yeah, so this is joint work with Professor Tim Chen within our group, and this is support level, and those are the people who did the real work, and we just give the talks. Thanks. It can interact with two domains, yeah. It can. You mean the how abundant? Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. We didn't look at that. Yeah, I think that's a good question. Yeah. Okay. I should get that reference. I think it's when we get to the fitness or the potential for this interaction, that's probably interesting. Yeah, that's another. That we did not take that into account. I must admit that structurally we don't have anybody in our group is doing structure, and for that part it's Russ Altman did some work on that part. It's inside of the protein, and then it's not interacting. Present, yeah. No internet. It had been done. I know it had been done. Yeah. We didn't. Why it's we don't have the expertise there. It's the other way, we did not really think about that before. We just treat it as single domains. Just if it does not have the domain, we just think this protein is that domain. Okay. Yeah. It can, yeah. Yeah, it can, yeah.
One more question, thank you.